I want to talk about the process of self-rejection. I see this process occur in myself as well as clients, and I think it's actually at the root of so many different forms of disharmony and the physical manifestation thereof, to include physical illness, financial difficulties, family relationship problems, and either career ambivalence or underemployment or even unemployment. I see the friction of life is due to misplaced energy, and that misplaced energy then leads to self-rejection, perhaps due to a sense or conclusion that we're ineffective. The static that we feel and hurt others with is self-rejection. I understood some years back that all disapproval is self-disapproval, and it's projected outward, so it looks as though the person we blame is actually responsible, and just the opposite is true. If we want to heal our tendencies to judge or criticize or find fault with other people, we should start with ourselves and healing our own self-judgment, our own self-criticism, and our fault-finding of ourselves. We come by this pretty honestly. That is, we've got a history of being taught about rejection. I'm a fan of the book that I recently was told about, called Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. And in it, Jesus is talking about bonding and rejecting as essential impulses for the existence of human beings, as well as other individualized beings, that is, plants and animals. And in fact, everything that's individualized and made visible is a result of these two impulses. It's not that these impulses are of bonding and rejection are bad. It's just that when they are driven by ego, they can get out of balance and out of whack. We need bonding. If you just think in terms of the cells of your body, we need the cells of our bodies to be able to bond, and so certain cells form our pancreas, and others the liver, and others the lungs, and others the brain, and so on. So we need the cells with the same function to be able to connect and bond to one another and cooperatively perform the functions of those tissues and organs. We need rejection in order to establish our individuality as human beings. We do this physically, that is, we want to be physically separated, and you can look at the birth process as one of those moments of physical separation where we could interpret that as the rejection of that state of by the mother of being pregnant. And so that movement outward, we need that. We need to be emotionally separate, so we reject being controlled totally by other people. We want this individuality. We want our freedoms. And you see this even in very, very small children trying to do things for themselves. I want to do it. I want to do it. They're pushing away controlling or guiding hands in an effort to express their individuality. We want the freedom to move, to feel, and to think for ourselves. And as Jesus said, these impulses cannot be completely eliminated, otherwise we would cease to exist as individuals. We don't want that. But he does say that when these bonding and rejecting impulses are under the control of our ego drive, that's what needs to be changed, exactly that. What that driving force is to those impulses. You can see bonding, that it would be ego-driven when it would include behaviors that you would look at and go, that person is trying to bond with money to an inappropriate level, and we would just say that's greed. And we've seen greed, we've seen theft, we've seen embezzlement, we've seen scams on small and huge levels like Enron and Madoff and the savings and loan scandal of some years back, and what has happened in the banking industry and the foreclosure. That's bonding, doing things to acquire money inappropriately. So you see it with lust, you see it with rape, you see it with any of these forms that are ego-driven. And really what I want to do, instead of talking about bonding, I want to talk and explore in this conversation what I've discovered about self-rejection, which is obviously a form of rejection. Some years ago in my journaling, I got the idea of management by disapproval, and I developed that idea over time through many journaling sessions, and to me it's a very interesting process. And it seems pretty obvious that most of us were brought up in an environment of disapproval, and so this management by disapproval has been demonstrated to us, and therefore as a result of that demonstration, it's been taught to us from our earliest days of our physical existence. Many, if not most, denominations of Christianity talk and teach that we've been born sinful. That is, because of Adam and Eve's failure in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve's failure in the Garden of Eden, we are sinful, we are bad, we are defective just because we're human beings. After the fall, as it is called, the story says that God rejected Adam and Eve and even the serpent, and as the Bible would say, condemned that snake to crawl on its belly. All humanity was allegedly rejected by God after that behavior of Adam and Eve. Christian theology, generally speaking, says that this forever, we are condemned and rejected forever, was changed by God because of Jesus' sacrifice and crucifixion. That is, because Jesus was tortured and murdered by human beings, we now have access to be bonded with God and no longer permanently rejected by God. So as we get taught that we are rejected and can only change from rejected to bonded by adhering to one Christian religion as it competes with all other Christian religions, every one of them is claiming to be the only way to get bonded to God. Only their way is the acceptable way to God. That, I think, can be challenged logically and with common sense as well. We've recognized that vibrational inputs to a fetus, this is us and other people before we're even born, are receiving vibrational inputs from the mother and outside environments. And these energies that are being processed, being recorded, being received by a fetus can contain the energies of rejection. Not everybody who gets pregnant wants to be pregnant. Not everybody who is having intercourse that results in conception wants to be having intercourse. And so you can imagine what is going on in some of those cases of conception, and then over a period of 9 months with physical discomfort and the dawning of other ideas of perhaps the financial pressures and the physical pressures and so on that are going to be increased as a result of having another baby. all kinds of rejections and woulda, coulda, shoulda get transmitted to that fetus. When it comes to learning about rejection in our lives, if we haven't picked up a bunch of vibrational rejection by the time we're born, just think of the traditional Western medical practice of delivering a child. And think of it, it is about pushing the baby out. It's not about welcoming the baby into the world. It's about pushing the baby out. It's more about eviction than a homecoming. And I think this aspect of birth and the traumas that are created in the baby and in the mother have huge negative impacts over the course of life and in the lives of millions of infants and later on those millions of adults. Think of it. Their first major and most dramatic physical experience is orchestrated by mechanics on the outside who are driven to get the process over with as quickly as they can, with the least liability to themselves, and keeping the mother and baby alive in the short term. They're not thinking any kind of long-term processes, but really it's about the short term. It seems to me that this process is akin to a dentist pulling an abscessed tooth. Let's get it over with quickly and completely. That doesn't sound like the most bonding way to bring a baby into this world. The trouble is that the baby is imprinted with all these going-ons in the delivery room and in the labor room, and that bad tooth that the dentist would handle is discarded, but this baby is going to carry whatever wounds this callous rejecting process imprints on them throughout their lives, unless they learn later in life how to heal those experiences and the impacts of those on them. While I'm on the subject of childbirth, let me mention that a medical study done by medical doctors in the medical establishment has determined that the main factor in whether a woman has a cesarean section or natural childbirth is this one factor, the anxiety level of the obstetrician. Isn't it unbelievable that in this day and age that a doctor's anxiety and level of fear is what is the decider whether a child is born in a head-first, natural, vaginal birth with all the benefits that accrue to a child born that way, or whether the mother and the baby are both disadvantaged with high doses of painkillers, surgery, and a non-natural childbirth. If we survive the birth process without long-term damage, then we advance into the age of the children, say 2 or 3 years old. And that's when they would have heard many people saying, even yelling, no, no, at whatever inquisitive behaviors that they display. A crawling child or a child who can reach things is going to be able to reach for things, is wants to reach for things. Children are, by their very nature, inquisitive. They're trying to learn. They're trying to establish their place in the physical realm. And by touching things and looking at things and putting things in their mouth and moving things is really what this is about. But we teach the child rejection, because by yelling no at them, by preventing them from doing what comes naturally to them, we are rejecting their natural processes of discovery in the home, in the crib, wherever they happen to be. Parents, teachers, siblings, even their childhood peers will use various forms of rejection on a child with the intention of controlling that child. Sometimes this control is an expression of growth or nutrition and nourishment or healing and protection. For instance, if a parent says to a child, don't play in the street, we can pretty much interpret that as a protective action on the part of that parent to protect that child from what is perceived to be the dangers of playing in the street. And when we add religious dogma to a child's diet, we stuff them full of God's insistence upon obedience, goodness to the point of perfection, which is an impossible standard that causes more destruction in the hearts and minds and families of man than can be imagined. And we're also told about God being wrathful when displeased with us or others. And of course, the greatest rejection possible in Christianity is to be told of being doomed to spend eternity in hell. Hell is the ultimate rejection that awaits people who buy into this theory, and heaven, of course, is the ultimate bonding activity. Is this the management by disapproval carried to extremes or not? At this point, the child would have experienced disapproval, which is either the threat of rejection or outright rejection at home, on the playground, in school, in church, and later playing sports, and later still in their work or even married life. Rejection and the fear of rejection as a consequence of disobedience to somebody else's rules is pandemic in society. So many people on this planet are tiptoeing around trying to avoid breaking somebody's rules for fear of the rejection. And in some countries, that rejection is imprisonment or even death. The Bible, by those people who claim it to be the unerring word of God, is weaponized by so many people to punish and reject those who don't go along with that point of view. People literally use the Bible to wage holy wars of rejection. At the same time, they can demonize certain radical fundamentalist Muslims who would use the Quran to justify holy wars against unbelievers. I think it's pretty safe to say that in both of these cases, what we have going on here is human beings who are obeying their ego drives of rejecting Christians, rejecting Muslims, Muslims rejecting Christians, and let's add Jews into there both ways as well, to justify this. We use this to justify this rejection. And obviously, if you look around the world and see what people are doing to one another in forms of rejection, we are really capable of horrible levels of destruction. And really, we have such an opportunity for constructive bonding. Let's see how all of this societal training and rejecting is playing out today. You can see it if you read the news, or if you still have the habit of looking at the 6 o'clock news. Bonding and rejection, those are going on in terms of the healthcare reform battle that have been waging for years now, and becoming really very intense in the last couple of years. Bonding and rejecting having to do with banking, wars, not only political wars within this country, wars of political parties, wars against immigrants, wars against terrorism, but in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and what's going on in various countries in Asia and Africa. It's unbelievable, the demonstrations of bonding and rejecting. The battle over taxes, whether they should be or shouldn't be increased or reduced, the consolidation of industries for the consolidation of power into the hands of a few versus into the hands of many. All of these bonding and rejecting conflicts are going on even as we speak. Rejecting, on a personal level, which really to me is the most important level, since the way we bond or we reject ourselves ripples outward. And those outward ripples from an individual start collecting other ripples of rejecting until this rejecting tsunami carries countries or political parties or industries or religions in one direction or another. As odd as it sounds, demagogues have always been able to bond the energies of rejection and direct them into specific directions. Hitler was able to do it, and dictators before and since Hitler have done it, and they do it today. If I looked at the Tutsis and Hutu tribes in Africa that massacre one another, and some of the other things going on in Africa, you can just imagine that massacring people is, on a physical level, the ultimate rejection. In this country and others, lynch mobs, manipulated wars against manufactured threats, imprisonment for picayune crimes of almost no significance, riots, are all rejective impulses, oftentimes orchestrated for someone's advantage and for other people's extreme disadvantage. So let's see what this can mean to you and me. I want to start with some basic elements in my explanation of the process of self-rejection. First, we have an individual. That's me, you, somebody else. Then we have our attention, which is our mental focus. All of us, to more or less, have the ability to focus our mental intellect, our mental energy, on one object or another. And the object that we focus our attention on is called, for convenience sake, the object of our attention. This is oftentimes something we want, and oftentimes it's something we don't want. It can be something we like, and it can be something we don't like. That would be our object of attention. We offer energy from us to that object of attention. Now, the word offer could be a little bit confusing because it's not all the time used in this way, but if you were to change that action and call it transmitting, we transmit energy to the object of our attention, or we broadcast energy to the object of our attention. We send energy of a certain frequency and intensity to the object of our intention. That makes more sense to most people. They go, oh, I'm totally clear on that. Looking at somebody and staring at somebody are two different levels of intensity of visual offering, if you will. Speaking to somebody and yelling at somebody or screaming at somebody are three different variations of audio communication to another person. We all understand that form of broadcasting. For most of us, though, there's an amazingly fast and therefore almost invisible step that occurs as we put our attention on that object. And that is, we refer to ourselves. That is, let me say it this way. We compare that object, what we want and what we don't want, whichever it happens to be in this example, we compare ourselves to that object and consider, calculate, computate our ability to use our resources, that is, our skills, our talents, our physicality, our mental capabilities, our strengths, our finances, our connections, our clout, our influence, any one of those things or all of those things. We instantaneously see and calculate whether we have the power to handle this challenge. Said in another way, based upon a model that I like to use of little circle, big circle, and equal circle, which is our viewpoint of ourselves within the context of a relationship. Let me just describe that a little bit. When we are born, one of the first things we start doing in our very early years is trying to make sense of the environment we find ourselves in. Early on, we start to recognize that we are separate, we're individualized from other things and other people in our environment. We arrive at this conclusion: we're little, they're big. We're weak, they're powerful. They're in control, we're not in control. And variations on that. That's a way to describe us as the little circle. When we look at other things, we see those other things as being more powerful and us as less powerful. What happens in the natural progression of things is, it could be in the terrible twos and threes, where we start rejecting some of the control that other people have over us, but more certainly it occurs consistently in adolescence. That is, this miscalculation occurs. Aha, I got it. This is a game of control. Either they're in control or I'm in control. And when a child misunderstands and believes that lie to be true, other things occur. From that point on, rebellion triggers, and that child is now going to attempt to get the upper hand or become the big circle within the family and relegate parents and others to the little circle. I've heard this conversation multiple times from parents who were my clients. I can't do anything with Johnny. Johnny doesn't take out the garbage. He won't listen to what I tell him to do. We can't control him. He won't do his homework. He hangs around with people we don't want him hanging around with. We just can't control him anymore. What should we do? This sequence of little circle, big circle, in the first one, the child was in the little circle, the parents were in the big circle. And then when the battle of control flips, then the child is in the big circle, the parents are in the little circle. The natural progression is for somebody to introduce respect into this relationship. Ideally, it would be the parents. And they would introduce respect of the child's need for independence, to make some decisions, and so on. They're not going to give the child free rein, particularly if something is going to endanger that child. They still have responsibility to protect and make decisions for that child. But they can also reduce the amount of control that they have over that child to allow that person to start developing self-control. And by introducing respect, it is likely that the child, him or herself, is going to recognize that something new has entered into the equation. It's not just a battle for control. There's this mutual give and take due to this respect being added. And so now what we have is what I describe as the equal circle. And if you were diagramming this on a piece of paper, I would suggest using three different pieces of American coinage. I would use a dime size for the little circle, a quarter size for the big circle, and a silver dollar for the equal circle. Now you would say the equal circle is bigger than the big circle. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the reason for that is twofold. One of which is, this little circle, big circle, they're both the same side of the coin of fear. That is, they both are based in fear. One is weakness or victimhood, and the other is in victimizer or predator or bully. And it is that trying to dominate a fear or a control, and the other is needing help to deal with something that is out of control. But both the little circle and the big circle are fear-based. And so people, for the most part, ping back and forth. They go to little circle, back up to big circle, little circle, big circle. And you can hear this in a work environment where somebody goes, oh, I needed so much help. I need help. I can't do this project. I can't do this report. I can't handle this. They're using their little circle behavior in order to get somebody to rescue them. And that works one or two or three or a certain number of times. But when that card gets played over and over again, that rescuer turns into a victimizer because they realize it was fruitless to try to help this person. They didn't want to be really helped. They wanted you to do it for them. But that equal circle is larger because it's not fear-based, it's respect-based. And it's also larger for another reason. In the little circle, big circle, one is it's because it's about trying to control, get somebody to rescue us or force somebody into doing something the way we want. In the equal circle, it's about cooperating. Those little and big circles don't really have access to the other person's energy cooperatively. The other person will resist giving that support and encouragement and help. But in the equal circle, because it's a give and take and it's respectful, both people are apt to help the other person succeed, be happy, accomplish what they want to accomplish, because there is a balance, there's a level of support, there's this level of respect. So in fact, an equal circle has more energy because they have the energy not only of themselves unthreatened, but also they have other people's energies that will be available to them should they need help. So when you look at this in the context of little circle, big circle, equal circle, you can see that when you consider some object of attention, you are going to put yourself in one of those three circles, and you're going to put the object of your attention in one of these three circles. I hear this described in the context of cigarette smoking. Person says to me, I can quit smoking anytime I want. And the same with drinking. I can quit drinking anytime I want. They are in the big circle. They are minimizing the danger, the risk. They're minimizing the other energy. They're putting smoking and drinking in a little circle. They're overestimating themselves and they're underestimating the other energy. That person inevitably is going to have a great deal of difficulty quitting drinking or smoking. When I hear, oh, it's so hard to give up smoking or drinking, it's so hard, this thing has really got me, they're in a little circle. They're giving all their power to whatever they just put, the smoking or the drinking, the cigarettes or the nicotine or the alcohol, into the big circle, giving it all their power, and they relegate themselves to this state of weakness, of victim. That person's going to have a great deal of difficulty quitting smoking or drinking. When I hear a person talk about either cigarettes or alcohol from the position of an equal circle, that is, I just have decided that I'm ready to quit smoking. It doesn't fit my lifestyle. I'm not enjoying it. It's expensive. There are clear disadvantages to that, never mind the cost and the smelling of it and the loss of freedom and the discomfort. And it's not what I want to do. I want to increase the distance between me and it. Now, you could say that's rejection, and it is, but you can hear it's also not ego-driven. It's a respectful, it's balanced, it's just I want more distance between me. I want to separate myself from it. That person has an extremely good likelihood of being able to quit smoking or drinking. When we put our attention on this object and we go into one of these emotional states of, I'll call them relationship states, little circle, equal circle, or big circle, I could also talk about when we put our attention on something, we're going to go into an emotional state. And I use 10 emotional states for convenience. The lowest of the 10 going upward start at shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride. That's the first seven. SAG, S-A-G, FLAP, F-L-A-P. And the top three are courageousness, acceptance, and peace, CAP. So SAG, FLAP, CAP. With a little bit of practice, we can get to the point where we recognize what emotional state we are in when we put our attention on an object. And that's very helpful, because really, we're not going to control the object of our attention. We're going to control our emotional state. We're going to be able to control and shift and heal our relationship state. And so what happens is, when we put our attention on an object, all of a sudden, there's a different energy flow that's created besides the one that we offer to that object. And it seems like it's a reversal of intention, like a boomerang, a counter-intention. It's as if there's a voice in our head telling us the problems associated with our relationship of being connected with that object of our attention. And the problems really are about us, not that the problem is my checkbook needs to be balanced. It's what it means about me. If I can't balance a checkbook, it's like I'm not good with numbers. I'm afraid what it's going to say to me is too complicated. You know, I'm not good with money. This is my avoidance, and this is my way of rejecting money, is not deal with my checkbook. All of that stuff gets instantaneously triggered, and it's happened so quickly that most of us don't even recognize what just occurred. All we can do is feel the vibration, and then we start to separate ourselves. This voice that is now magnifying the problems associated with our relationship with whatever that object is, it talks to us, and it tells us, and it's selling us, and it's accessing all kinds of images from our history, why we shouldn't go ahead and do something, why we shouldn't get bond with us, why we shouldn't get it handled, why it's too hard to handle, why we don't have the capabilities of handle. And it magnifies and it blows up these things, the negatives, and it can let the wind out of our sails so quickly. I had this thought to do, I'm not going to now. And it really can sabotage our follow through. You've heard of this general concept, but not in terms of self-rejection. You know related ideas, and they've been labeled as risk-reward analysis, considering the pros and cons of a given activity or course of action, the reasons for something and the reasons against something, weighing the positives and the negatives, and looking at an investment and the return on investment. And so these risk rewards, all of this stuff, is the analytical aspect of it. But in fact, this happens so quickly in terms of self-rejection that it's a whole different ballgame. At the same time that we're comparing ourselves, our capabilities, our history of images related to similar objects of attention, we will direct some percentage of our rejecting energy back at ourselves. We could say that this combination of bonding and rejecting causes friction or static electricity in us. This energy is self-rejection, and most of us are unaware of how we just caused it. Instead, we are like the person who on a cold, dry winter day builds up static electricity by walking across the carpet. When the staticky person touches another person who comes into the room, the static electricity is discharged and hurts the innocent person. There are obvious symptoms of this phenomenon. We will feel it as if we have one foot on the gas pedal and one foot on the brake. It could be called procrastination or paralysis by analysis or even being stuck in a rut. Just imagine this for a second, that you're in a restaurant and you want to have a beer, and you're looking around and you start to consider whether you should walk over to the bar and get it. And then you think of how many people are at the bar and whether it's too crowded or you're going to have a hard time jostling for position to get the attention of the bartender, or if you're going to wait until some wait staff person comes over and asks you if you need something else, and then you consider how much work they got going on, how busy they are, and everybody is clamoring for their attention. And what you're really doing is you're starting to create counter-intention. You're starting to create resistance. You're starting to create oppositional forces within yourself just regarding something as minute as asking for another beverage in a bar or a restaurant. More appropriate for a lot of people is this idea of a part of you wants to ask for help. However, as soon as you think about asking for help, this voice starts and starts telling you all the reasons why you don't want to have help. And I don't want to bother, I don't want to ask, I don't want to take a chance on being rejected, I don't want to be told no, I don't want to seem silly, I don't want to whatever it is. I want to be able to maintain my individual. I want to be able to maintain my individuality, that is, the image I have of myself. It's more or less a myth that I can do it all by myself. That is not going to happen. Self-rejection is based upon us expecting and judging ourselves incorrectly and harshly. We judge ourselves as being inadequate to handle the situation, be it ask for help, and whatever consequences are inherent in that. If a person says no, it's like chances are we're going to live through it, but we start to magnify the consequences to be particularly damaging, particularly threatening, particularly risky, and then we stop doing that. We do the same thing on a regular basis when we choose to put our focus on an object of attention, and we create this static, this self-rejection in us, and then we project it out onto the other thing. You can literally look at your disapproval being expressed, your dissatisfaction being expressed, or criticism, or condemnation, or fault finding, or sarcasm. You could look at that as you express it, back up 30 seconds, 3 minutes, or 30 minutes in time, and you will be able to find that point of self-rejection. And as we become more aware of this and how we display it, we can interrupt that cycle. We can prevent it from continuing in this downward spiral and choose higher vibration thoughts related to it. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of a prayer in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth, in letter 8. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. It is so. Thank you. Amen.